Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Burchie. Justin's here.
Hey everyone. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been like a couple of months. What have you been up to?
Craziness. I've been moving.
Yeah, right. So you moved into a bigger place.
New bigger place. Got some new gear. Got my new fancy Mac Pro.
Yeah, you bought... Okay, I know you probably don't want to say, but would you say what you spent on that thing?
After tax and AppleCare, around $7,000.
Okay. So it's a $7,000 Macintosh.
But Zach, it's a little cylinder.
Yeah, it looks like a little garbage can.
It would be too small for a garbage can. It's like a slightly oversized 2-liter.
Right, but this thing is like the fastest thing on the planet, right?
Photoshop launches in 3 seconds.
Yeah, there you go. And you're doing mostly video encoding and shit with it. Like.
Right. So, you know, I'm going to use that horsepower.
Right.
Although most of the apps that I use aren't yet optimized for the new graphics chipset.
Okay.
So, you know, I have to wait for Adobe to do some updates.
So the machine is faster than the software knows how to handle.
Right, like literally, it'll be going. I'm waiting for the software to chug through, and I'm checking the CPU, and it's at like 60%.
And you're like, "Hey, now."
Yeah, like you could be going faster. You can do better. Here's the thing, though. Apple's gotten so good. You've never been an Apple guy, but they have this app in there when you first launch it called the Migration Assistant.
Right.
And if you owned a previous Mac, or even a Windows machine, it'll say, hey, hook it up either by Ethernet or, you know, hook up your old hard drive by USB, something. We can access the old hard drive, transfer all your software and everything over. I'm like, cool. So I rip out the old hard drive of my old Mac Pro, stick it in a dock, put in the USB 3, come back in an hour and a half. It's restarted. Everything's right where I left it. Everything is, like, all the settings are transferred. All the apps launch perfectly. I'm like, wow. It's like I don't even have a new computer.
Well, it's like buying an iPhone.
I didn't have any other things to do with it, so I was just like, okay, guess I'll put you to sleep and go to bed.
Well, yeah, that's the experience of buying a new iPhone, because you said I've never been much of an Apple guy, but I'm 100% Apple on mobile, so
right.
Tablets and phones, I'll only buy Apple product. PC, I go with PC.
Right.
But that's what it's like, you know, 3 or 4 generations later on an iPhone, you get a new one, and it's just a new iPhone. It's not, yeah. You know.
Okay, I guess you're faster, but no lag.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, well. It's not exciting anymore. It'll be fun when they make, like, some kind of major OS change or, I don't know, something's got to change there in order for that to be exciting again. It's nice to have a new one, but, yeah.
Sure. And then, let's see, I also got a video projector.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about what this is like, because I've been thinking about a projector, but it seems daunting, and, like, I always imagine, my image of a projector is always a little washed out.
I am shocked. Like, I finally got it perfectly mounted on the ceiling this morning. Like, all the stuff, like, drilling holes in the walls and, you know, mounting the screen and everything was a pain in the ass. And I probably will lose my security deposit on this place.
Sure.
I actually lost a screw in the wall.
Whoops.
Yep. That said, I got a 120-inch gain screen. And it's just like, you know, those ones they had when we were in school, the pull-down type. Like a window shade.
Okay.
But game screens actually reflect more light than normal. It actually, like, that's why it's gain.
Right.
So, and the screen, or this projector, is super bright. So on a bright night, it's actually a little too bright.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, you get used to it. But it's full 1080p with the nice sound system. It is every bit as good as being in the theater.
Wow.
I mean, I haven't seen Nebraska yet. I'm going to just wait a week for it to show up on iTunes rental, because it is like, there is no point in going to the theater at this point.
Oh, yeah. I actually watched that last night. You can just get that Blu-ray out of a Redbox right now, actually.
Oh. Or I'll do that.
Right, yeah.
So, what? Yeah, it's a pain in the ass to get it all set up. It's not that expensive. It's around the same price as a decent flat screen. The screen set me back maybe $200 delivered, and the projector itself was a grand.
Yeah, which, you know, when you're pricing out, like, big expensive TVs, that's on the low end.
Right. And then you have, you know, you have to get the long HDMI cables and power cables from you know, Monoprice, but that's one order. And, you know, you get a mount, and it's a little bit of work, but it is so worth it. And I had my buddy over last night. I popped in Pacific Rim. Mm-hmm. And, like, he wouldn't let me turn it off.
That's really cool. So are you doing 3D on it?
You can. I don't give a shit about 3D.
Right.
And you have to buy the glasses extra, and they're like $40 each. But apparently it does 3D pretty well.
Okay. Because I was thinking, like, you know, you get that kind of crazy-ass setup. You know, Gravity came out this week. Like, if you're going to do, like, a tech demo-y, like, holy shit, what can my screen do? You want to push it. Like, seems like buying the 3D Blu-ray of Gravity and trying it out on that thing might be kind of hellacious. I don't know.
I don't care about 3D. I just don't.
Yeah, sure. But if you were, it exists. Right. You can get it.
Right.
That's cool. That's cool, yeah. I've been... My TV is old. I really need to replace it.
Oh, but you sold the same one that you had a couple years ago?
Yeah, I'm still using that old thing. I gotta get rid of it. It's time. But, you know, once tax season is over and we're into the summertime and it's time to make a big purchase, I'll replace it. And I'll definitely look at projectors, because I didn't know they were that affordable. Or yeah, at least something looked good.
It's full 1080p. It looks amazing. It's bright. It's crisp. It is like... it barely has a screen door effect anymore. You don't even see it unless you're up really, really close.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you should swing by. Take a look. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, of course I will. So have you been watching anything? I know things have been really busy.
Finally watched From Up on Poppy Hill.
Yeah, tell me about that. I still haven't seen that.
Oh. It's nowhere near as bad as everyone says it is.
Were people saying it was bad?
Yeah, a lot of people hated it. They thought it was boring and pointless.
Yeah.
And it is yet another, like, you know, wistful school day slice of life show, which,
right,
you know, Japan needs to really, really stop, but they're not going to, because that's the only point, apparently, in Japan where people are happy with their lives.
Mm. Okay.
Right. So, at any rate, it's really well animated, and it really captures the time period and kind of the feeling of place really well. It's not the most cohesive story-wise, and the ending's just like, okay, well, that's it. It's very cute, and it gives me a nice feeling watching it, and I'll probably watch it again. I'm happy to have the Blu-ray.
It actually goes on sale every now and then. I hesitated at the $12 price point and shouldn't have. But, yeah, I want to check it out. Because most of what I heard, I didn't really see a lot of negative opinion about it. It's just like, oh, it's not quite Miyazaki. And, well, hey, it's better than Earthsea. Like, those are kind of the two things I
put it a few notches above Cat Returns, at least.
Okay, well.
That's not okay, damn, faint praise.
Right.
Damn it with faint praise, but I enjoyed myself watching it. It was cute.
Cool.
One thing that G-Kids did on the credits that annoyed the piss out of me, though, rather than listing what everyone did, they just said, here's a Japanese production staff. Bunch of names.
Uh-huh. Really?
Yeah.
No individual credits.
I mean, they listed all the names, but they didn't break out what they did.
Right, no individual credit. It's just, hey, here's everyone who worked on this.
Yep.
That sucks.
I mean, they broke out, like, the top build people, but aside from that, it's just like, were you an in-betweener? Or were you a sound effects engineer? Who knows?
Actually, that reminds me. So I wanted to ask you about this, because I was talking about this on Twitter earlier today. So since I just announced that they are putting out that show, Mao Yu, you know, the economics with demon girl with huge tits thing, like,
right.
It's kind of like a Spice and Wolf sort of a thing, but, anyway, it was popular when it came out. They're putting this out, no dub, sub only, all 12 episodes on a single BD.
Yeah, I just got an Answer Man question about that.
Okay, cool. Well, this episode will be out tomorrow, but I wanted to get your take on this because my immediate response is, well, that's going to look like shit. But then I was realizing, like, oh, well, you know, Warner just put out the third season of Adventure Time, which is the same runtime. It's 26 episodes, but those episodes are 11 minutes long, which equates to 12 22-minute episodes, right?
Mm, right.
So same amount of time, same amount of episodes, but that disc apparently looks fine. And Adventure Time is not a cheaply animated show. That show looks pretty good.
Right.
Lots of bright colors and fluid animation and stuff like that, and all the reviews are saying, hey, this looks great.
So, now, I'm finding review sites can be trusted less and less to actually be have a good eye critically for video quality.
Okay.
Like, honestly, there's been some stuff, even I've put out that I'm just like, I hope no one really gets too upset about it. Not one review website raised the red flag. I'm like, yes.
Well, you're hyper critical of this stuff, but I'm just curious, like, so in other words, when you see that announcement, we're going to put all 12 episodes of this on one BD. Do you assume, well, that's going to look like shit?
Well, like, the easy answer is it's Sentai. Of course it will.
Well, now, all right.
I mean, that's unfair. They have released a couple good discs.
They've released plenty of decent stuff.
Yes, yeah. So. I'm concerned.
Right.
Yeah, there's only one audio track, but stereo audio isn't that big, even if it's uncompressed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that much room we're talking about, extra room we're talking about.
Right.
Maybe room for one additional episode, not four or three. It's possible it will look good, and if it's compressed right, I think it can. Will it? I'll withhold judgment until those screenshots come out, but I'm concerned.
Right. So in other words, the hesitation saying, like, you know what, that's probably not going to look good, not necessarily unwise skepticism.
I don't think so. I mean, if you're bringing the bit rate down, which is what that requires, you have to bring down the bit rate, and, you know, you have to really, really know what you're doing compression-wise and resort to some dirty tricks, like, you know, filtering out some light things just so it doesn't start blocking up. And I'm not sure that they know how to do that.
Well, at least nothing you've seen suggests that they're...
Nothing I've seen suggests that they have the skill at compression that would indicate that I would feel comfortable giving, you know, with that arrangement. Well, I would have to run some tests before I would feel comfortable doing it. Okay. I've never tried to squeeze that much on a Blu-ray.
Have you ever been asked to?
No.
Yeah. So most people,
if they're doing Blu-ray, care about the quality.
Mm. Yeah, and somebody mentioned that. They're like, you know, if I'm buying a Blu-ray, I want archival quality. Like, that's why I'm buying this. Otherwise, I could just watch the stream.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, what purpose does physical media have in our lives now other than, like, best possible, you know, archival quality?
Yeah.
You know, knowing it's always going to be there in the best possible format. If you're going to half-ass it, don't bother. Everyone can just, you know, stream it.
Yeah, and there's a precedent for them doing this, but they haven't done it in a long time. I think the last show they put out where they squeezed 12 episodes onto a single BD was Tears to Tiara or whatever the fuck that was.
Right.
And I remember that getting nothing but complaints about the video quality.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, so, I mean, well, but that was a long time ago. That was years ago. So, who knows? You know, technology's changed. I'm sure their staff has changed a little bit. I don't want to be too, like, oh, this is going to fucking suck. I just wanted your take as somebody who does this for a living. Like, how cynical should we really be about the potential quality of this?
Well, let me put it to you like this. If a client asked me to do that, I would, A, try to talk them out of it, B, run some tests, give them disclaimers like, look, I'll do this if you really want. I don't know how it's going to turn out. I don't take no responsibility.
Yeah. It'll say, you know, in the production credits, your name will be Alan Smithy.
Oh, I don't get credit half the time. Right. NIS is the only client that's nice enough to actually put me in the credits.
Oh, well, that's nice of them.
It is. They good kids.
So you saw it from up on Poppy Hill.
Yep.
Anything else?
It's been so long since I've been on, I forget what I've talked about and what I haven't.
Last time we had you on, I think you said, like, I've watched nothing.
Oh, I finished Free, finally.
Oh, how'd you feel about that?
You know, the funny thing about that show is that it is the least gay sports show I have seen in a long time. Despite the slow, lascivious pans over ripped male bodies and lots of flesh, those characters are fucking straight as an arrow.
Well, the show is basically, like, designed to be pretty family-friendly, like, in terms of story, right? Like,
right, yeah, there's nothing, even, like, the guys might as well be eunuchs, like, they have no sex drive at all.
Right, sure.
But they're not, like, pawing at each other, or there's not even a hint towards a yaoi relationship.
Okay, I didn't watch all of Free. I saw the first episode and thought it was like, hey, this seems fine, you know, like, what?
Hey, you know, it's well animated, it's a really, truly decent sports show, and, you know, that's good enough.
All right. Yeah, I never really felt a strong desire to go back to it, just because it felt like sort of the, you know, animated equivalent of like a sort of a treacly, really predictable Japanese, like, underdog sports movie.
It takes some interesting turns. It's not quite that kind of dry. Oh. I actually like the writing in it. But yeah, it won't come as a huge shock to anyone, but it was the ending wasn't quite where I was expecting it to go.
Well, there's another season coming.
Woohoo!
So there you go.
Yeah, and if you want your gay sports anime, you better go back to Big Windup.
Yeah, well, that one was a little more overt. the only things I've been watching, I'm catching up slowly on Kill la Kill. Just because people don't, like, that show has sort of lit people on fire, so they don't shut up about it. And now I figure, like, now's the time to finally catch up, because I'm tired of hearing people talk about it, so may as well just watch it. I liked the first, you know, episode that I saw, but it kind of turns into this thing where it's like, ugh, I am so tired of hearing about Kill la Kill, I better just sit down and watch the damn thing. Which is counter to my usual thing, which is, oh, I'm so tired of hearing about this. Unfollow all these people. Ignore it. Don't watch it for another year or two.
Well, it's like, it's too many people to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's people I really respect and admire.
Same with Space Dandy. I'm like, damn it, I'm going to have to watch this now.
I really don't know how you're going to feel about Space Dandy.
Because
I don't think you're gonna, honestly, I don't think you're going to like
all it. Flash and a little substance?
Oh, there's no substance. Like, none. Like a tiny, maybe a tiny bit, but there's that show is absurdist, sort of surrealist, but also incredibly dumb. And every episode is, hey, what do you want to do? Let's do this. Okay, fine. Like the last episode was, we have these two ideas, neither one of which can fill an episode. Let's mash them together awkwardly, and then that's it. I like it because it's experimental. It is just a playhouse for Watanabe, and that's fine, and I enjoy that. But I don't think you would get too much out of it.
It sounds like the sort of thing I'd enjoy watching once just for the visuals.
Well, I think you would really appreciate the visuals. Personally, I really just like the way the show looks. I love the color design on it so much that I could just sit there and stare at it all day. I really love the color design. I think it is one of the best looking shows from an art perspective that I've seen in a long time. So if that, you know, if you're cool with that, just like, oh, this just looks neat, then great. You know, you'll have a good time with it. Just once through and then you forget about it immediately. But yeah, so those two, really haven't, been.
Well, let's face it. We're movie nerds. So every chance we get, we're going out and watching the Oscars, our Oscar movies.
Yeah. I finally caught up. I finally saw everything nominated for Best Picture.
That's a lot of movies.
Nine. It's not that many.
Okay. let's see here. Let me pull up the list here.
Yeah. I'm happy that one of two movies I actually really liked will probably win.
Which is?
12 Years a Slave is probably going to win. Gravity might have an upset.
Okay. I definitely need to see 12 Years a Slave. That's one I'm waiting for the rental on. Let's see. Fuck Wolf of Wall Street. I've decided no.
I loved that movie, but okay.
Let's see. Loved Gravity. I still don't say it holds up to repeat viewings all that well because all the tension is gone, and that's all that movie was, is tension.
Yeah, sure. Of course.
But the craft of it is amazing. And honestly, I want to see that win for the score.
It's a lock. Well, I don't know if it's a lock on score, but it's a lock for all the technical categories, at least.
It's incredible. I don't know how they shot 98% of it.
Right, and I don't really want to know.
Right. Let's see. Her, as we've mentioned, is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Phillips, I couldn't bring myself to care enough to go.
I enjoyed it. I waited until it came out on video, rented it. I liked it a lot. I thought it's the rare kind of a film where you know the hero of the movie survives, mm-hmm. but the reason the movie's compelling is because you want to know what happens to the bad guys.
Right.
Because you don't really know. And that's what makes that movie pretty compelling. Great performances in that movie. It's totally solid. It has absolutely no chance of winning anything at all, but it's a good movie. Like, you know, I always say, like, if you watch every single thing nominated for Best Picture, you will see 9, 10 really solid movies. There's going to be something in there you will really like.
Right. I see you didn't care all that much for Philomena.
Yeah, you're a big fan of that movie.
That movie just destroyed me.
Really?
Yeah, just destroyed me. I was sitting there in the theater. I told you this story privately. I was sitting there in the theater, two-thirds full,
mm-hmm.
and it took everything in my power not to cry ugly.
Really?
Like, be that guy just violently sobbing in the theater. I had to hold back so hard.
I was sitting there, I was watching this movie, and I don't know, I just...
For me, it's only yesterday level poignancy.
Wow. Really? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so it got me right in all the right places.
Wow. Well, I mean, I can totally appreciate that. I thought it was a little... Hope described it as being extremely British in execution, which means it's kind of... it's, I don't know, I guess sort of excessively a little dour. I don't know. I didn't connect...
It's not a happy story.
It's more, I think it's more that I felt it was like 25 minutes of story in a 2-hour film.
Like Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, sure. Okay. All right.
Except that was 3 hours, right.
What I meant by British in execution is it's rich old people in very opulent rich old houses discussing rich old families. Like, that's not the whole movie, but that's the part I was like, hey, this reminds me of British movies from the 70s. That was awesome.
Wait, Philomena?
Philomena, yeah. I mean, like, it's not...
Nobody's
it's not
rich in that movie.
British, but it's got some of that malaise, I guess. For lack of a better word. But I didn't dislike it.
I do not understand that criticism at all, but okay.
I think it's more like very sincerely talking a whole lot about your ancestors and your lineage and that kind of thing. I don't know if you can really describe it that as like a... It's a little bit of an abstract thought, but I just didn't really connect it that much. I appreciated the story. I thought it was... It seemed like a neat short story to me. Like an entertaining and interesting short story. Like, I was kind of waiting for it to get to the point.
Well, the point was the journey. That was the point that was made at the end.
Yeah, sure. All right. I just didn't connect with it very much.
You have no soul, Zach.
That's not true.
Well, at least you didn't like American Hustle. So.
No, I hated American Hustle.
I didn't hate it quite as much as you did, but I just like that was one of those movies that like I enjoyed it in the moment in the theater, and the minute I stepped out and started thinking about it, I'm like, okay, that was not very good.
Yeah,
and then now months later, all I remember is Amy Adams' side boob.
Sure, yeah. I don't know. David O. Russell used to be a different guy. He used to make different kinds of movies. I really love I Heart Huckabees. I haven't seen it in a while, but
I Heart Huckabees also gave us the best outtakes in cinema history.
Well, people are saying like that those outtakes being leaked broke him, and now all he's doing is just trying to win. He's just trying to win Oscars and favor and make popular films that are popular with the kinds of people that vote for Oscars. And I would agree with that. I couldn't necessarily refute that. I don't know.
I really liked The Fighter.
The Fighter was very enjoyable, but that was also a really populist film.
Right, it was a crowd pleaser, but technically I thought it was, you know,
That movie felt a lot more real. There was an emotional arc to the characters. You could connect to them. They felt...
Oh, absolutely.
They felt... It didn't feel like... A friend of mine described American Hustle as... famous people putting on a 70s costume skit. And that is totally what that movie feels like.
Yeah, pretty much.
Except they're all eating the fucking scenery and hamming it up, like, in every possible corner of that movie. Like, and the Red Letter Media guys put it really well, too. They said, like, David O. Russell doesn't even care enough about the story in this movie to even try to make us care about it. Like, he just wants to put the camera down and let the actors fucking knock over everything on screen. Like, and that's boring. Like, I'm not so charmed by the presence of Jennifer Lawrence that just seeing her on screen makes my panties wet. Like, I'm just not that interested in it. It really sucked. I was totally bored. And I thought the movie was really hideous. Like, it looked like a parody of the 70s.
See, I hold the 70s with a sense of tactile revulsion.
I'm going to mail you my copy of Supervan, Justin.
Please do not.
You want to be repulsed by the 70s, you want to watch Supervan.
Don't need it, I have the actual 70s.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really fill out a ballot this year. For whatever reason, last year just didn't really set my hair on fire in terms of the Oscars. I think I know pretty much what's going to win, and that's good enough for me. Did you see Dallas Buyers Club?
I did not. I wanted your take on it because a friend of mine did not like it because just as a premise.
Well, the movie itself is perfectly fine. It just feels like it's out of time. And by that, I mean it feels like it should have been made in like 1995.
Right. I mean, it's asking us to sympathize with a callow, homophobic piece of garbage, and his redemption is he's less of a piece of garbage by the end, right?
His redemption is that he helps a bunch of people with their disease by creating this drug cocktail.
Oh, well, that too.
What I'm sort of amazed by is that Jared Leto is apparently going to win Best Supporting Actor for his role in that film.
Yeah, what the fuck is that?
Which is generally just... It really is kind of just like he plays this drag queen character that's kind of funny, and then he gets really sick. That's kind of... He doesn't have much more character than that.
The Oscars are geriatric actors, and that's a sad clown.
Yeah, I don't know. That movie's perfectly fine. I just didn't get that much out of it. And it really felt like it should have been made in the 90s. Yeah. Aesthetically, too. Like, it feels very 90s. Uh-huh. I don't know. I don't know how much you'd really get out of it, but... And then, I mentioned, Nebraska was the last thing on my list, and I saw that last night, and it is Movie for Old People.
Not a deal breaker?
No. Again, it's fine. It's an Alexander Payne movie, so what you get is a lot of...
Alexander Payne?
Yeah. What you get is a lot of punchline followed by slow dissolve. Which started driving me a little crazy, because it happens over and over again in that movie. But it's black and white, and I don't think it needed to be black and white. That seems like a totally unnecessary aesthetic choice to me. Mm. I get his point was that the Midwest is sort of monochrome. But
say that again.
Yeah, but it I don't know. It just didn't really seem all that necessary. It gets a little bit better in the last half. Otherwise, it's a whole lot of people, a lot of really old people talking to each other in the way that old people talk to each other. And there's, like, funny scenes where old people are, you know, sort of talking past each other and ignoring one another. And the way family members get along when they're in their 70s and 80s and stuff like that. For an Alexander Payne movie, like, I've come to realize, like, he makes movies that are kind of, like, time and place. Like, he gets taken with this particular place and this particular atmosphere, and then he wants to set a dramedy in that particular place and atmosphere. So you had Sideways, which was this movie except in Napa Valley, and then you have this movie, which is Sideways, sort of, in the Midwest. But it's always ensemble cast, similar kind of comic beats. There's always kind of a caper that, like, there's always, like, a wacky caper that's punctuated by no music at all. this is all very specific to his movies. But he is kind of... It's all focused on just time and place. So lots of shots of cars driving down roads and turning into buildings. By that I mean, like, you know, parking. just a lot of lingering shots of landscape. He really is he wants you to soak in this particular environment. The story isn't necessarily compelling enough to get you to get your rapt attention for the whole time. And it's not funny enough to really get your rapt attention the whole time. So it's just kind of an okay experience, but I don't know. I used to think Alexander Payne was like, oh, this guy's going to make a great movie someday. And I think he's made a lot of pretty good movies and hasn't made a great movie yet.
I still really love About Schmidt.
Yeah, I think that's another one like this. I like that movie. I think it's perfect. I think it's good. I think it's entertaining. I think it's funny. I don't think it's great. I think the closest he got was Election to making a great film. But even that falls short. So,
Election I had a lot of problems with.
Really?
Yeah, like I liked it in... I liked a lot of pieces of it, but the whole last act just fell apart for me.
It totally does, which happens in a lot of his movies. And actually, Nebraska, I think the first act kind of sucks, and then it gets better in the second and third act. So maybe he's reversing his thing a little bit. Sideways, I feel, falls apart a little bit too, especially in the middle section. But yeah, there's always some sagging parts, and the Descendants I thought was totally overrated. I don't know.
I had no desire to see that.
Yeah, well, that was his Hawaii movie, right? So,
right.
Soak in this for a little while. And so, yeah, okay. But yeah, so.
So that's the Oscars, and we'll shut up about all those movies now.
Yeah. We're finally done with that, and then we can move on to this year. So tomorrow I'm going to see The Wind Rises, finally.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm happy, from the sounds of it, I'm happy to watch it dubbed because it sounds like Hideaki Anno does not a good voice actor make.
Well, he's not a voice actor.
Right.
He's just Miyazaki's best bud, so. I'm really curious to see his performance, but I'll buy the Blu-ray and I'll see it on that. But yeah, it'll be.
I saw a few clips of the Japanese version. I'm like, ooh, really?
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't watch anything. I saw like a trailer.
I'm dying to see that. I'm dying to see Ernest and Celestine, which I saw the trailer of, and it looks amazing.
Yeah, and it's not going to win on Sunday.
No, of course not.
But our friends Mike Sinner-Nicholas and Stephanie Shea worked on that.
Yep.
And so seek it out.
They're super stoked to have their movie in the Oscars.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. So seek it out. I'm very curious to see it. It's still playing in L.A., so maybe I'll get up there at some point. But I imagine it'll be out on DVD real soon. Usually anything nominated for an Oscar gets shunted out to DVD. Like
I see Stephanie literally just posted on your Facebook wall, have you seen Ernest and Celestine yet?
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly. Yep, so, right. But yeah, okay, so, I wanted to ask you, are you watching True Detective?
No, I don't have HBO, so I gotta wait for the DVDs.
Okay, well, you should.
Yeah.
It's really good.
It's that everyone's been shitting their pants about it, and whenever this many people shit that many pants, I have to watch something.
Yeah, that was my attitude towards it.
This is how behind I am on HBO shows. I haven't finished John Adams yet.
Oh, okay. I watched John Adams as it aired. So that was, yeah. I watch all the stuff as it airs, though. I actually pay for HBO, so.
It's pretty great on the big screen, though, because that it can be a little slow if you're just watching it on TV, I imagine.
Well, yeah, sure, I guess. I prefer getting it week to week. I kind of wish I had started watching, because, you know, neither Hope or I like cop shows.
Well, so. I mean, anytime something threatens to be a procedural,
yeah,
why would you watch that?
I'm fucking out. Like, I'm just not interested. But everybody was shitting their pants over it so much. It's like, okay, we should sit down and watch it. So we watched the six available episodes, like, in the last, like, week. And it's fucking excellent. It's a character thing. It's not about the mystery. It's not about solving the mystery or procedural or anything like that. It's just a character piece that has a lot of interesting shit going on. I think you would really like it. So yeah, check it out.
All right. Yeah, I will definitely do that as soon as I have the chance to do so. And. Oh my God, the pile keeps growing.
All right, man. Well, let's go ahead and get to this interview because we got a lot to talk about here.
Yep.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to ANCAST. I'm Zach Birchie. Joining us this week, we've got a little bit of a special show here and a little bit of a sad show, but it's important that we do this kind of thing. Justin's here.
Hey, everyone.
And we're joined by a previous guest, previously of Band Entertainment USA, and now he works at Legendary Comics, which is the comics subsidiary, spin-off division of Legendary Pictures. You know, they handle things like Batman and Godzilla. it's Bob Napton. Bob, thanks a lot for showing up.
It's great to be back.
So we're here today to discuss something very specific. We recently lost a man by the name of Kevin Seymour, who a lot of people don't know, but made a huge impact on the anime industry in North America, and I think probably responsible for creating, in a large part, awareness of anime in America, if not, you know, one of the chief architects just through his work of American anime fandom in the 90s and in the early 2000s. Once you hear his credits, you'll understand what we're talking about here. Kevin Seymour was the ADR director, so he directed the dub for, let's just go down the list, Akira, Ghost in the Shell, Ninja Scroll, Macross Plus, Perfect Blue, Wings of Onyamas. I mean, these are legendary credits. Like, this guy, I mean, his influence can't really be overstated. If you became an anime fan in the 90s, you watched a lot of his work, and unfortunately, he recently passed away, and we didn't get a chance to interview him. And one of the stated goals of ANCAST is to record the history of people who built fandom and the industry for anime in America. And Bob, you knew him for most of his career, right?
Yeah, I actually knew Kevin 26 years, which is a crazy thing to say out loud, but I met him In 1988, actually, when I went to work for him at Books Nippon. So he goes way, way, way back. And I knew him before he started becoming before he became an anime dub director. I mean, he kind of had a whole career at Nippon that led into him forming his company Animes, which was responsible for the English language versions of all those great shows you mentioned and many, many more.
So you met him when you started working at Books Nippon. So what did he do there? What was his role there?
Well, it's pretty amazing. Kevin came into Books Nippon before myself and David Riddick. He actually was the one that was kind of the first man on the moon. I mean, I say this with some confidence. I think Kevin was the first American to be hired by a Japanese company to work in an anime department. He was at Books Nippon long before Carl Masek hooked up with Harmony Gold. He was there before Viz even existed, before any of these other companies, you know, before Animego. So Kevin was really kind of the first guy to do that. And he was brought into Books Nippon to specifically sell the imported books, CDs, and material that Books Nippon was bringing into its store, of course, all anime, and also the big mail order thing that they did, which was basically a catalog mail order service. And Kevin was brought in to manage all that. And he's the one who really grew Books Nippon anime department to be what it was. He was the one who said, okay, let's start going to American comic book conventions. Let's go to Comic-Con and start selling anime goods. And the management of Books Nippon was like, well, if you really think American comic fans will be interested in anime, sure. So he was the one who kind of spearheaded that whole outreach. And it had a tremendous impact on the industry. I mean, there's so many stories I could tell. But one I love that Kevin always shared with me is when he first started at Books Nippon, it was probably 1984-ish. They sent him to Japan to meet with all the publishers who were publishing manga and anime art books at the time. And he went to Tokuma Shoten, who published all the Nausicaä art books, like Art of Nausicaä and the This Is Animation, I think. And they were just so amazed that an American was coming to talk to them about anime. They were like, I don't know what to do. We should have someone important. So when Kevin got there, Hayao Miyazaki was there to greet him. And Kevin had an amazing picture of him, a very young Kevin Seymour standing next to a fairly young Hayao Miyazaki. They just were like, you got to meet this guy. It's the first American to come to talk to us about anime. So, that gives you a sense of kind of where he was at when he started. It was really impactful stuff going on.
Wow. So this would have been about when?
I would have been about 1984, and I've seen the picture. It really happened. I mean, he was very – the funny thing about Kevin is you alluded to in your opening. He was kind of – some people have asked me about him since he passed away. It's like, what? Why did I never meet this guy? You know, he was such a figure around the same time as Carl Masek and Torrance Smith and all these other people who are unfortunately now gone. But Kevin was kind of – what I've said is he was sort of the J.D. Salinger of the anime industry. He was just a very private person. He didn't like doing interviews. I don't think he ever did one panel his entire career. He was just a very kind of shy guy, but he loved anime and loved doing what he did. So, but that was about the time he started. So he was kind of way ahead of everybody. I really do think he was probably the first – guy to be working in an anime company, quote unquote, before anybody else, which is sort of a remarkable thing.
So up until the point you got to Books Nippon, what was his work in those years? Because that was like a good 4 years before you got there, right?
Oh yeah, no, he's the one who hired me. Literally, as things started to grow, he hired David Riddick, and then they needed more help, and David recommended me, and Kevin hired me to come and work for him. So he managed the whole department, and his goals then and what he was doing was very, you know, I mean, this is 1984, 5, you know, 83, 84, 85. So this was pre-digital, pre-anything. So it was a very analog business. He would go to
just barely had VCRs back then.
Yeah, exactly. So he would go to conventions. He would sell the books. He would sell the imported items. And he started a fan club, which was called the Books Nippon Fan Club. And the members would basically send their address, and then they would get catalogs about the new items, because of course there was no, you know, it was basically just a mail order business, and then they would fulfill those orders out of the Books Nippon office, which is where Kevin worked. He never actually worked at the store, but he helped supply the store with all the anime and manga that they sold. And so that was really his thing, going to the comic conventions, because there were no anime conventions, and really trying to grow the awareness for anime. And I remember even when I came on board, which was a few years later, it was still kind of like, who are those guys in the back of the dealer's room of Comic-Con selling books that no one can read? I mean, it was a very slow thing, but he always pushed the envelope of trying to bring the fans in, because he really knew there was a market here and really wanted to grow that. And he started becoming the guy to talk to for a lot of artists and people who were interested in the aesthetic of anime. I mean, I remember Mobius coming up and giving Kevin a big hug, and I was like, how do you know Mobius? You know, and he was like, oh, he's been buying from us for years. He's very interested in anime and manga. And tell you the truth, this is a true story. A lot of people know Mobius and Miyazaki became great friends and like these amazing companions, these two artists. But it was actually Kevin who introduced them via Miyazaki's work, because Kevin gave Mobius a copy of one of the Nausicaä art books and said, this is an artist you should look at. And Mobius fell in love with Miyazaki's work and then ended up becoming friends with him in real life. But that, in a weird way, that was because of Kevin giving him the book. So there's a lot of little things like that during the Books Nippon days where Kevin was really making an impact and really helping grow the market.
Well, what are you, did he ever share with you like how he got into this stuff in the first place? Like what was his background like?
You know, again, being kind of somewhat reclusive, you know, he discovered anime, I think. He was definitely not one of the guys like at the CFO. That was not Kevin. He was very much a book collector. He was very into the works of Philip K. Dick and Ray Bradbury. So he used to go to conventions for that. And then he discovered, I think, anime just like we all did back then, through some sort of accidental moment of either stumbling on something that looked interesting to him. But he never actually specifically told me what it was, or if he did, I've forgotten. But he was kind of on the fringe of the scene, but he was definitely not in that, you know, anime fan club tract. That was not what he did. But he was an avid fan of movies, of science fiction authors, of music. He was a huge fan of music. He actually used to bring kind of obscure music to Comic-Con, and we would sell that at the Books Nippon booth along with all the anime goods, just as something fun for him to do. So, yeah, that's pretty much how he came to it, just sort of being around the fandom and the science fiction scene.
So what, as things progress, what role did he take as you were starting the whole VHS thing?
Right. So yeah, the first thing he started doing was importing those crazy expensive Japanese animation VHS tapes from Japan that were, you know, obviously not dubbed or subbed, and we were selling those for like $120 for a VHS tape, which I'm not sure even then I understood why they were so expensive coming out of Japan. I mean, I think all VHS were expensive, but those were incredibly expensive.
Those were like two episodes, right?
Yeah, there were two episodes or like one movie. I'll never forget, Macross, Do You Remember Love? The VHS tape was like $160, and people were buying this stuff. I mean, obviously a very select audience. But what happened was, because of Books Nippon position in the industry that didn't really exist, I mean, because Books Nippon was kind of the only place that had an anime department, kind of everyone came through our door. You know, Carl Masek came before he started Streamline. After he left Harmony Gold, he had kind of a whole pitch about working together. Torrance Smith, John O'Donnell, in fact, we actually helped create U.S. Manga Corps, and Kevin and John knew each other. Basically, we were the one-stop shop to talk to people about anime. So one day, Kenny Adomi walked through the door, and I remember it very clearly. Kevin said, oh, we're going to be meeting this guy. He's coming from Japan, named Kenny Adomi, and he wants to talk to us about video distribution. And I was like, okay. And it turned out to be Ken, who became a major figure in the anime industry here. And he was coming with Gunbuster and Dangayo. And Kevin really
he's working for Bandai Visual already?
Yes, yeah, yes. Absolutely. So he came as a rep of Bandai Visual. And Ken and Kevin became really great friends, actually. And they were both interesting because they both were kind of the opposite sides of the same coin. Ken was kind of the guy coming from Japan who saw that who believed there was an American market for anime videos. And Kevin was the guy in the U.S. and David Riddick who really pushed for the founding of U.S. Renditions, really believed that there was a market here. So that's how U.S. Renditions really was born in terms of video, was that fateful meeting between Kenny Adomi and Kevin and myself and David. And we started doing the subtitle releases around the same time as Anime Ego, selling 2 episodes for $34 on VHS. And that's kind of how the whole video market was born. And, of course, you know, John O'Donnell and others came in and really helped, you know, blow the door open. But yeah, that was kind of the early days, and Kevin was definitely a part of that, and he would design all the packaging. I mean, he's a very talented guy, multi-talented, and this was of course all before he even thought about starting his own company, but he was very hands-on. You know, I remember on the Black Magic M66 VHS, like the logo could glow in the dark and things like that, and we had these sort of unusual shaped VHS tapes. The shells were kind of different than your standard VHS. So all those interesting little choices were all made by Kevin, who really wanted to kind of have it look like a slightly higher quality product than some of the other, you know, tapes that were coming out.
Yeah. Now, if you could just describe, like, who did what back then? Like, he did the box art. What else was he in charge of, and what were you all doing?
Well, he was the manager of the department, so he pretty much ran it, and he reported to the Books Nippon president in the U.S., Mr. Nagata, and then later Mr. Iwasaki. Kevin was pretty much responsible for everything. I mean, for putting out the product, for doing the conventions. He made all the kind of command decisions, of course, with our influence. And then once U.S. Renditions started, the way it broke down was I would sort of do the story editing stuff on the scripts. And David would also do the same thing. And then Kevin was kind of the one overseeing all the elements. Like he would oversee the subtitling process with working with the studio. And that's when he really started to kind of fall into the path of becoming an anime, you know, voice director and an anime, you know, producer, for lack of a better term. In fact, like on those VHS tapes, I think it was Kevin. I'm pretty confident it was Kevin who started color coding the subtitles. Like, okay, green will be song lyrics and yellow will be dialogue and white will be thoughts. And believe it or not, everyone started copying, you know, I mean, a historian may debate it, but a lot of companies started copying what we were doing, and that was all Kevin. Like, oh yeah, let's color code the subtitles so they mean different things. So he was very hands-on, pretty much involved in every facet of those early VHS releases.
Now, were there any particular, what was he like to work with? And if you could try to paint a picture of like what he was like day to day.
He was a very funny, very eclectic person. I mean, like I say, anime was one of his passions, but he was not your typical anime fan of that era. I mean, David Riddick and I came up through like anime clubs in LA. I mean, we were very much like going to the, you know, meetings on Saturdays and sitting in a room with people and watching anime on VHS and, you know, third generation copies. But Kevin was coming much more from a broader place in terms of his interests. He was very into music. He was constantly playing music in the office. You'd come in and he had a little tape recorder and he'd play it at a low volume. You know, this is the day before everyone had an iPod, of course. And you'd be like, oh, Kevin, who's that? And he'd be like, oh, it's this little obscure band and blah, blah. And it would turn out to be all these major bands that would become popular later. He had this amazing sense of kind of what was going to be cool in a couple years. And I think that's how he found anime. He just, more than anyone I've ever known, he really had just this amazing radar for pop culture. With books, with music, in general. And you know, on a day-to-day basis. I mean, he was a very funny guy. He had a kind of very sarcastic sense of humor. I mean, all the bizarre situations that one encounters working in the anime industry, as you guys know only too well, were even more prevalent, I think, back then, because it was just such the Wild West. No one really knew how to, you know, do anything, and like get, we weren't even getting approvals, you know, on packaging. They were like, ah, do what you want, you know. So just the bizarre situations, you know, that would come out of things.
Gee, sounds pretty nice.
You know, it was, yeah, it was a fun time. I mean, a great example was like Kevin wanted to get a vault to put the masters in, like a real vault, because there was, you know, the Books Nippon didn't want to pay to have it vaulted somewhere. So he's like, well, we got to figure something out. So he kept researching. One day I come in and there's like a shotgun safe that has been installed in our office at Books Nippon. And there's like a little emblem of a shotgun and a deer. So it's like a hunter safe. And I was like, Kevin, why is there a hunter safe here? He said, it's the cheapest safe I could find. It's the only one they would approve. And he laughed about it. He's like, so we're kind of the redneck anime guys now. So just stuff like that. He had a great sense of humor, and you know, he would find the humor in the bazaar, and the bazaar is certainly part of working in the anime industry then and now.
Now, those early U.S. renditions releases were kind of noteworthy for their austerity is the wrong word, but they were very workman and took absolutely no liberties with adaptation. They were really almost like how fans prefer it today. You know, minus the name suffixes, of course. Was this part of his aesthetic? Did he have any sort of viewpoint he espoused on how anime should be presented?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he definitely was a purist, I think, using that term then and now. He really felt like it shouldn't be tampered with. You know, he wanted to make it accessible. Especially with the subtitling, he was very like, yeah, we don't need to, let's just do it. Let's do it straight. No frills, no need to embellish on the stories. You know, of course, when you get into dubbing, it gets a little trickier because you're trying to adapt the dialogue and the story to fit the mouth movements and all that. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was, it's funny, just an example, a non-anime example, but as I mentioned earlier, he was a huge Philip K. Dick fan. He owned every copy of every Philip K. Dick book ever published. And I remember one time I hadn't read, I said, hey, Kevin, you must be a huge Blade Runner fan. And he was like, have you read the book? And I was like, no, because I hadn't, you know. He said, you should read the book. The book is much better. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? After you read the book, let's have a conversation. So he was a purist. I mean, about everything that he enjoyed, including anime. So I think that's why those releases were sort of reflected in that. And also that was the time when there was a little bit of the Robotech backlash going on, fairly or unfairly, that, you know, Carl's approach of like quote unquote westernizing things. Was it maybe the right way to go? And Kevin never explicitly told me, like, I don't think that was a good idea. But I think he definitely wanted U.S. renditions to represent a different way. And so did David Riddick and myself.
So if you could kind of go over how I believe U.S. renditions sort of self-destructed when L.A. Hero got bought out. Is that pretty much how, if I'm remembering things correctly?
Well, what really happened was this. So Kenny Adomi came back and decided to start his own company in 1992 called LA Hero. And he came back to U.S. Renditions and Books Nippon and said, well, now I want to start dubbing and releasing anime, but I'm no longer with Bandai. I'm doing it on my own. And he had a couple titles already he had licensed, including Macross 2 and Giant Robo. And so... through the process of doing those early dubs, and Orgus, which Justin knows only too well what those dubs were like.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Doing those early dubs, what happened was Kevin really became a dubbing director, because at that time when Kenny Adomi had those licenses, he was like, you know, I want U.S. renditions to handle the production. I don't want to deal with that. So you guys will handle production and distribution. and a result of Kenny Adomi kind of putting that ball in our court, Kevin sort of rose to the occasion, and not through any, we never discussed it. We never like, okay, David, I think you should direct, or Robert, you should write the scripts. It just kind of happened. And Kevin just sort of became the obvious one to sort of become the director. And so he directed all those early dubs using a pseudonym, which I think was Quint Lancaster. And he used a lot of pseudonyms. It was just this funny game he liked to play. Like he had like three or four that he put on various releases. And that's really how he became a dub director. And then what happened was after those initial rounds, you know, I had been at Books Nippon about 6 years. And I'm using Books Nippon and US Renditions interchangeably, of course, because it was really one company. And Kevin came to me one day and said, you know, I think Books Nippon for me has run its course, and I think I've kind of found my passion with this dubbing thing, and I think I'm going to start my own dub company called Animes, and I'm going to leave Books Nippon. And I'm like, well, if you're leaving, I'm leaving, because they're going to try to get me to do all your work, and I don't want to deal with that. And David Riddick had already left at this point. So the original team just kind of disbanded. And to be honest, with all due respect to Chad Keim and the talented people who came in after us, I think it was Kevin was really – Books Nippon was really Kevin's thing. He's the one who built it up. And without him, I think management just sort of lost interest. And that's why it sort of imploded. But he went on and formed Animes, and he worked with LA Hero and Zero Limit and Pioneer, and he started getting video game clients, and then just had his whole career as an anime director.
Now, what was the relationship between, because Zero Limit and Animes, I could never tell them apart. Where did one begin and the other end?
Well, they were actually two separate companies. Yutaka Maseba, who also I worked with at LA Hero during my brief stint at LA Hero, it's all very complicated, but if you want to know the minutia, Kenny Adomi decided to sell LA Hero to Manga UK. And when he did that, Yutaka decided to leave and start his own company, which was Zero Limit. So Zero Limit and Animes tended to work hand in hand. Like if Yutaka would get a license, he would hire Animes to do the dub. And Kenny Adomi then went back to Bandai and started hiring Zero Limit and Animes to work together on titles. For example, Cowboy Bebop being probably the most famous, which was a title Zero Limit and Animes did together. So they often worked together, but they were actually two separate companies run by two different people, Kevin Seymour in the case of Animes and Yutaka Maseba in the case of Zero Limit.
I see. Now, he was known for being a little on the expensive side, but turning in some of the best work. How much experience did you have? Like, did you ever go there for sessions? And what was that like? They didn't even have their own studio space, if I recall.
Yeah, they worked mostly with Magnitude 8. Yet another company. So, yeah, they were really the three amigos, Les Claypool, Yutaka Maseba, and Kevin Seymour.
And for the record, this is not the Les Claypool from Primus.
No, which he always is famous for correcting. So, yeah, the three of them really were the three musketeers producing all those great shows. And, I had left the scene to become a comic book writer, which we talked about in my last interview. So I was really out of the whole thing. And I remember sitting somewhere watching Cowboy Bebop. And I was just, literally, I can't tell you how proud I was of everyone, because this was Steve Bloom and all these people I had known from those very, very rough and tumble early dubs of Orgus and Guyver. And just seeing what they had become and what they had grown into and how good the quality of the work everyone was doing just blew me away. And I remember getting in touch with Kevin just saying, you know, I'm just amazed what you guys are doing. It's just great stuff. And they did become known as a great dubbing house. And I think what they were, though I don't know all the details, and obviously this kind of goes with the waning of the anime industry, but at the time when they started, you know, it was the emerging of the DVD market, those early 2000s when things were pretty much the solid days of the American anime industry. Everyone was making a lot of money. Everything was going well. So I think their pricing and the volume of work they were doing was based on that. And then, you know, as things started their painful downward spiral, I think it the appearance became of them being expensive because a lot of other houses came up that were basically trying to, you know, get their name by coming in a little more affordable. So I think that's how that whole thing got started. But I did go to a couple of sessions just as a visitor while they were recording. And I have the and this is a funny story that tells you a little about Kevin as a person. I have the pleasure of being the only person, the only voice actor, the only voice in LA that ever got kicked out of a Wallace session by Kevin Seymour for being so terrible. And,
That takes effort.
It does take work. I think he was dubbing. I think it was when he was directing Akira. He called me and he said, "Hey, you know, you should come and be here for this. You know, this is one of the big moments." And I was like, "Yeah, I'd love to." So I went to Magnitude and hung out for the day. And he said, "Hey, do you want to go?" And what, if, for people who don't know, Wall is basically you get five or six people in the recording booth and they all start yammering at each other, not really saying anything. And it's used as crowd noise and inconsequential background dialogue. And he's like, "Why don't you go into the Wall session so you can say your, you know, voice in Akira or whatever it was?" And I was like, "Sure." So I went in there and I, you know, I have no aspirations to be a voice actor, never even, you know, played at that when we were doing those early dubs, you know, didn't like some people were like, "I'll do a character." And I, that wasn't me at all. So, but I went into the booth and so I'm talking with the actors and making up stuff. And I just hear over the headphones, Kevin's like, "Okay, Bob, can you lower your volume? 'Cause you're kind of throwing everyone off." And, I was like, "Okay." So we did it again. And then he just comes out. He said, "Bob, I need you to get out of the booth." And then we went in. He was like, "Oh, I'm so sorry, but it just doesn't sound right, you know?" And I was like, "Kevin, I get it. I know who you are. You're a perfectionist. I totally understand." And it's true. He really was a perfectionist. I mean, he had this amazing ear and he just wanted things to be the way he thought they should be. And to be honest, I think that's why his dubs that he directed are so highly regarded, because his attention to detail was just amazing. And whether you love the dubs he did or didn't love the dubs so much, I can tell you for sure he was absolutely determined to make them the best they could be, because he really cared about the stories and presenting what the artists in Japan and the directors in Japan had done as best he could, you know, in an English representation of that. So, yeah, I think it shows. I really do. I think he really cared, is what I'm trying to say.
Were there any dubs that he ever expressed real, like, "I'm really proud of this one," or "I'm like, oh God, don't listen to that one. That one didn't turn out"?
I mean, I think all the early stuff was painful for everyone.
Right.
Just because it was done under the worst possible circumstances, which I alluded to on my last appearance. But
yes, the literal cave.
Yeah, they were literally recorded in a cave. But I know he was really proud of Bebop, though he didn't necessarily direct those. Mary Elizabeth did, as I recall, but he produced it. Like, he hired her to direct it. And I know that was one that meant a lot to him, because it was just so well regarded and it was on Cartoon Network continuously for 10 years. And, you know, it's a dub that got a lot of traction. I know the redub of Akira that he did, he was really proud of. And Wings of Onyamas, he was really proud of. He did a redub of that as well. And Code Geass, which was actually his last big series before, the industry kind of totally imploded in 2008 or whenever that was, in Bondi Close. That was one he was really proud of and really loved. He really loved that show. But I don't think there was anything he ever felt, you know, except for those, you know, early ones like Guyver and Orgus, which, you know, other than that, I think he was pretty happy. And he worked with some celebrity talent. He worked with Bryan Cranston. I know, you know, Breaking Bad is everyone's like thing. And
hey, he wasn't a celebrity yet.
He wasn't a celebrity yet, but Kevin hired him and worked with him on Macross Plus. And we worked with, he actually brought me back just to hang around because he thought it'd be fun. Kiefer Sutherland on Artemis 3 and The funny thing I remember about that, Elizabeth Berkley was in it, who was a famously just coming off her Showgirls kind of whatever that was, train wreck.
Yeah, that was not a good reputation at that point.
Yeah, and I remember she came into this dubbing studio, and this is another story that'll tell you something about Kevin. He said, you know, I know you're this notorious actress and I'm supposed to know who you are, but to be honest, I don't. I've never seen any of your movies, but it's great to meet you. And it was totally, he's being totally honest, but it was so handled so well. It just put her at ease. And she's like, yeah, it's so cool. Like, no one ever says that to me anymore because of Showgirls. So I'm kind of glad you don't know who I am. And it was just one of those moments I happened to be there for. And it was kind of classic Kevin. He had a way of just kind of, you know, he didn't let people put on airs too much around him. So he was just like, oh, that's cool. You're Keith Sutherland. Great. Now this is what I need you to do. You know, he was just very efficient and just wanted the product to be great. So,
yeah. So we're talking a little bit. It's basically towards the end of this guy's visible career. It looks like you said Code Geass was one of the last things he did. You know, towards the end of that bubble, but that was also years ago.
Yes.
So did he? What happened? So he did Code Geass. Bandai sort of implodes. Did you keep in touch with him? Like, what do you know? Do you know what the last 10 years were like?
Yeah. No, I did. In fact, kind of the. You know, sad thing for me about the whole thing is sad in the sense of. None of us really got to, see him again, really. But the hard thing for me was he called me a few weeks before he passed away because he was moving into my area. And we had kept up on phone and email, but I hadn't really seen him in a couple years. And we were just literally arranging to get together for lunch. And I was like, great, you know, when you're in the area, let's get together and we'll have lunch. And he was like, great. He sounded great. And then very suddenly, a few weeks later, he was gone. So that was definitely a kind of a big shock for everyone. I mean, in the years since the anime industry had kind of, I mean, basically what happened is all of his clients disappeared. You know, Bandai Entertainment was gone, Genyon was gone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think he got a little tired of the fight, you know, of trying to survive in a market that was, you know, sadly, very much collapsing for in terms of dubbing and opportunities. You know, it's hard to dub a show if there are no companies left to hire you. So he just went on to do other things. I mean, I think he took a bunch of time off. He got back into collecting and got really, really into rare books and things like that, like buying and selling rare books and just kind of followed his muse wherever it took him. So, I mean, he was... I don't want to say he was in retirement, but he was kind of in semi-retirement, you know, pretty much after, I think Bandai Entertainment closing was kind of the last straw for him. And he just saw the writing on the wall, as a lot of us did, myself included, and said, okay, it's time to find something else to do.
Was there any thought of saying, okay, well, hey, I directed all this stuff that literally everyone who's ever heard of anime has heard of. You know, these are the movies, you know, there's no Miyazaki in there, but he did direct, you know, this is stuff that if you've heard of anime beyond Studio Ghibli, you've heard of this stuff. Was there any thought of like, well, I'll go to another studio and, you know, maybe I'll, you know, do some work over at Bang Zoom or, you know, NYIV or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he did have conversations like that at times with those different studios, and they talked about different projects. And, you know, for whatever reason, it just didn't happen. I mean, I do think part of what happened with his career was he was so entrenched with animes, as Justin pointed out very, I think, astutely. You know, the lines between Zero Limit Animes and Magnitude 8 were very blurry. I mean, they almost functioned as one company for like 10 years. So when you do that, I think when you're suddenly like trying to connect with other companies that you've never had a relationship with, that became difficult. Like, so he hadn't really been a director for hire. Okay, I'm working for Bang Zoom. I'm working for NYV. I'm going to go to Texas and work for Funimation. He wasn't that. He was just very much doing his thing with this one group. And so I think it was just either unappealing or difficult for him to kind of branch out at the end of his career versus if he had been doing that along the way, maybe it would have been a little easier. I mean, I'm just guessing, but that was kind of my sense of it. Like, he's like, well, I'm just doing my thing with my guys. And then when the industry kind of collapsed and like I say, most of his clients closed, you know, I mean, they just weren't around anymore to hire him for jobs. He just kind of saw that as a sign and decided to, you know, put it behind him for better or worse.
It also sounds like maybe, you know, this was a person who was used to a certain pay scale that didn't exist anymore.
Well, there's probably that, and also just a certain way of doing things. You know, I mean, it's hard to kind of come off a 10-year experience and then suddenly you have to. I mean, you know, everyone has to deal with this at some point. But you know, things certainly were of a certain way in terms of pay, in terms of not even, I mean, they didn't even really have to go find projects just came to them, you know. I mean, it was just a unique situation because they built his company built up such a great reputation, you know. People were constantly knocking on the door, and then, as we all know, you know, those knocks slowed down and then stopped altogether for a lot of us. And a lot of the companies were gone. And Bandai Entertainment, though it was around up until a few years ago, had really reduced dubbing to almost like nothing. In fact, I think Code Geass was the only show we dubbed out of that whole group. We started doing a lot of sub-onlys again and because the sales just weren't there. So, it was unfortunately, Kevin helped grow the industry. He lived through the beginnings. He saw the peak and then he saw the end. So it's kind of, I think he had the most interesting perspective, and it's regrettable that he didn't choose to talk about it because he came in so early and was there till the kind of quote unquote the bitter end. And not to say the anime industry is over, but the one that we all kind of knew is over, and it's now become something else with Crunchyroll and all these other companies. So he had a really interesting perspective on things, for sure.
What was your personal favorite in his oeuvre, as it were?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. But honestly, Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex, which he directed, I think almost every episode of the first season and second gig, and that was another one he just adored and put so much of himself into. Getting it right with all those crazy translations and the, you know, all the weird Russian, you know, references and just deep, deep, deep stuff. He loved that. He loved the minutiae of that series. So if you really want to watch a series and say, what was Kevin Seymour about? It's probably Standalone Complex. That was one that I know he always said, I am the laughing man. You know, he would make a joke about it because he was so famously reclusive. And he would always make these jokes to me about, they don't know, but I'm the laughing man and stuff like that. So he was really funny. He had a good sense of humor.
You know, that's there's a parallel I kind of want to draw here. And I don't know if it's 100% accurate, but what this sort of story is reminding me of in terms of somebody who is famously reclusive but had a massive impact on at least one particular realm of entertainment. This is a little like John Hughes. Who had a huge impact and was a famous total recluse, like would not talk to anyone, but everyone who knew him said he was a great guy, you know, left us earlier than he should have. And now people just talk about his legacy.
No, I think that's an amazing and a very accurate parallel. I mean, if you talk to, you know, Kenny Adomi or any of the voice actors he worked with. I mean, there's a couple hundred probably coming to his memorial here in a couple of weeks. He was beloved in the circles, but yeah, he didn't need that public recognition. And I think that's a very, very accurate parallel. I mean, he did so much to grow the industry and he just didn't need that kind of recognition or acclaim, or he just wanted to do his thing and do it well and do it with the people he liked and, you know, his colleagues and friends that he cared about. So he was very interesting that way, because, you know, obviously at the same time you had other people who were much more vocal and much more out front about what they were doing. Like Carl was a great spokesman for his point of view and what he wanted to do, Carl Masek. But Kevin was just not like that. Yet they were peers and they knew each other and they talked all the time. And so it's really interesting. It's really interesting that to see people like that who just want to do the work and do it well. You know.
Okay. Well, actually, I think that about wraps us up. Really can't thank you enough for coming on and talking to us about this. I know you were close to him, and it still must be difficult to deal with. But really, I think it's important that we hear this guy's story and people learn about him and maybe seek out more of his work. Even though, like most anime fans, like if you've seen anyone's work, you've seen this guy's work. It's just so ubiquitous, you know. But
there's a couple hidden ones in there, like the Blackjack OVAs.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I recommend everyone go to Anime News Network and look up his credentials. Just type his name into the search box, and it's a laundry list of stuff really anyone should see. I mean, just, you know, let's look it through this list. It's just thing everyone's heard of after thing everyone's heard of after thing everyone's heard of.
it's
such an impressive resume, and he really left a massive legacy behind, and I'm glad we got to hear at least a version of his life and his impact on the industry here. So Bob, again, can't thank you enough.
Oh no, thank you guys, and it's been a pleasure to come on and talk about him.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Bob for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can find them at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.